Okay, you know what? Tonight's attendance is 260. Seems like a nice round number. This is my favorite part of the meeting. This is what we're here all about. I would like to introduce our speaker for tonight, Scott R. from Los Angeles.
My name's Scott Redman. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Thank you so much. Thank you, Bruce, for asking me to come talk tonight. And I'm just having a great night. I've been this is a great meeting. I've been treated with great love and care, and I have a lot of friends here tonight. A lot of people who I've known for a long time, who I'm just so pleased to see. This is just absolutely fantastic. I want to welcome the newcomers to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome to AA. And I can't imagine coming into a better meeting. I'm greeted at the door, and if you're new and the GSR seemed a little odd to you, eventually, if you stick around Alcoholics Anonymous, believe it or not, after a while, this stuff starts to sound like music. And once you understand what AA is organizationally, it's really is music, because you really see AA working in a profound way. If you're here tonight wearing adult diapers, I guess that doesn't matter to you very much right now. Adult diapers could have kept me out there for about 5 more years. I'm really glad that Depends didn't really hit the market for a long time. It's a trick glass. I was born a poor child in the Bronx in 1951. We had a leaky roof. What are you going to do? You're going to sit and let it run on you? Sit down and watch it run, dear. We had a leaky roof in my house, and it was terrible. And if you knew, this probably makes you want to go to the bathroom. Okay, there you go. Thank you very much. But welcome to AA. Welcome if you're a drug addict. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're a dope fiend, which is somehow worse than any of us, welcome to AA. If you're the Bigfoot of dope addicts, a dope Goliath, a crack monster, that's scary. I'd like to welcome all the tweakers. Welcome, tweakers. They have no short-term memory. They don't know. They have already forgotten what they're applauding. All right, Shelby. Let's see. Welcome, tweakers. If you've ever licked all the features off your own face, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you've ever masturbated until you're dehydrated, welcome to AA. I'm not making fun of you. I'm coming pretty close, though. But I like you guys to stay quick for a while, wear your clothes out from the inside, and and I really mean that, because I don't care what you got. I really don't care if you're the Energizer Bunny of dope fiends. Just catch alcoholism. If you can catch alcoholism, if you can stick around long enough to get a diagnosis, please, please do. I did not come to Alcoholics Anonymous as an alcoholic. I didn't know what alcoholism was. I caught alcoholism in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. The infection enters through the ear, and it started infecting me, man, and it took me a while. I didn't even talk about it for a while because I was scared of being asked to leave. I was scared that I was just a drug addict. I was scared of a lot of stuff. I didn't understand what it was, and I couldn't have possibly been alcoholic. I'm Jewish, and Jews don't drink, you know, because it might dull the pain. You know, you don't want to squander any agony opportunity. And in addition to the Judaism, I couldn't possibly have been alcoholic because I had been in psychotherapy for 18 years. I was going to be dead, but I was going to understand it. And I'm not putting therapy down. Therapy's great stuff. It says on page 133 of our book, if you need a doctor, go get one. I've used therapy many times in sobriety, much to my benefit. And I don't have any malpractice insurance, so I'm not in the habit of telling people what doctors to go to. My colossal mistake was I was trying to treat my alcoholism with psychotherapy. Yikes. It's like showing up at a gunfight with a knife, you know, once a week, and get these colossal ass poundings once a week. Now, the idea of therapy, most conventional therapy, is to uncover, discover, and unravel, to free associate, to shed light on things, to maybe delve into your past, and to analyze these things. And two, if you're neurotic, just neurotic, if anybody here has ever been referred to as a neurotic, I don't know if you have, but let's say a neurosis is an unsatisfactory resolution for anxiety, which means that your answer to your anxiety creates more anxiety. Your solutions are worse than your problems. I don't know if that resonates for anybody here. I'm a guy who left alone. I told my wife about this. I'm making the bed for the first time in a century, you know, and I unfurl the sheet. Wow. Is your old man here or what? No. I unfurled the sheet, hooked myself behind the head, and drove my head into the bed. And I said, you know, I can't do this. So I'm not a great problem solver to begin with, but so that's the idea of therapy, is to come up with a better resolution for your anxiety so you solve your neurosis. But I have alcoholism, so I'm going to therapy. I feel terrible. I feel terrible. Why? Well, I was so drunk today that I was too drunk to walk, so I drove. Well, what are we going to do about that? What are we going to do? Let's talk about it. I got it. Let's talk. What were you thinking just before you did it?
Nothing. Nothing.
I feel awful. Why? Well, yesterday I sharpened a hypodermic needle on the back of a Matchbox Striker and fluffed up a cigarette filter and sucked some heroin up through it and injected. I feel miserable. What are we going to do about that? What were you thinking just before you did it?
Nothing.
Now, I want to tell you, everybody here, if you've been here any appreciable amount of time, understands what I mean when I say nothing. What it says in the seventh chapter of our book that we're to talk to the new alcoholic, we're to share the strange mental twist that precedes the first drink, exactly the way it's done in the chapter on alcoholism. Because even though we look like we got it together, we're cleaned up, we are, you know, we're not wearing Depends until we're 40 or 50 years sober, you know, it's a different deal. That if I share that strange mental twist, this alcoholic will know that I know my business, I know what I'm talking about, and I haven't picked it up in my reading. And I went to therapy. I grew up in the Bronx in New York City to a completely insane family. My wife never believed me about my family until she met him. And my mom threw an engagement party for us, and my Aunt Rose came to the party wearing her wig backwards. And it had a bun on it, so the bun was bouncing off her forehead all night. And you could have just thrown a net over the entire room. I mean, it was there just psycho. I had an uncle who was one of the top 10 welterweights of the world during the 1930s. His name was Izzy Redman. He was concerned about anti-Semitism. He was fighting in Atlanta, Georgia during 1939, and he changed his name from Izzy Redman to Izzy Goldberg so that no one would know he was Jewish. I wish I was lying about this. These are my people. You don't go to the bar and brag about this. You don't go to the bar and say, I'm a moron, I'm from a long line of morons. if you got anything for free in my family, meant it was stolen. And I had an uncle who was a welder who used to get free bales of steel wool. Like, here's your check and your complimentary bale of steel wool. And his wife took a decorating course and made throw pillows and filled all the throw pillows with the free steel wool. So when you were at their house, if you looked at the room, everybody was moving a little bit. You know, it was like a big, living, pulsing, breathing thing. They're crazy. Crazy. And there was chronic institutionalization and suicide attempts and mental and physical abuse. And my family didn't have one single solitary thing to do with making me an alcoholic. And if you knew, that might sound really weird. But what I'm telling you is, I'm not telling you that I wasn't injured. I was terribly injured by my childhood. I grew up with crazy people, and I was hurt really badly. But I have alcoholism. I have a bizarre mental twist. I have this weird thinking that I still have, 18 years and 10 months in, still have it. That's why I do what I do in AA. I was about 14 years sober, and I needed surgery on my hand. And this doctor said to me, you know, you're going to need general anesthetic. And I went, oh, general anesthetic, that's great, man. Normal people don't get excited about general anesthetic. No normal person goes, oh, general anesthetic. You're generally anesthetized for general anesthetic. You're unconscious. But I know something about general, man. They hit you with it, and they say count backwards from 100. And you go, 100, 99. I love 99. I love 99. I still have the thinking. A couple years after that, I'm 16 years sober. And I go to another doctor. He says, you know, you're going to need the same surgery on your other hand that you had on that hand. I said, I guess we'll be having some of that general anesthetic. He said, you don't need general anesthetic with that. I thought immediately, no, I need another goddamn doctor is what I need right now. Let's get a second opinion quick. If my family had made me an alcoholic, the therapy would have worked. I had good therapy. I could have worked out my family issues and my family problems, and I could have drunk like a normal person. But I have this weird thinking, and it leads me to take a drink that I'm cut out from society by a couple of dimensions of alcoholism. One of the most distinctive is the fact that I'm physically allergic to alcohol. I can't stop. I can't moderate once I begin. If you're special and a drug addict, try some controlled crack smoking. Just fill your mouth up with crack smoke and say, I'm not in the mood. Blow it out, and we'll make you president of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll tell you right now. I'll run your campaign. Yikes. So I grew up in this nutty family. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I, pretty young, overcame my alcohol problem with marijuana. I'd like to welcome all the pot smokers here tonight. You remember WOW, right?
Wow. Wow.
Right after WOW usually came...
What? What?
Wow, what? Wow, what? Wow, what? Wow, what? Wow, what? Wow, what? Watching a pot smoker is like watching a dog try to run on linoleum. There's like a lot of activity, but no movement. They cannot get a claw in the rug, man. And I overcame the marijuana problem with pills. I'm going to talk about drugs. I didn't come here to piss anybody off. I swear I didn't. And if I did, I'm sorry. Talk to Bruce. He called me, asked me to come up. I didn't call him and ask to come. But I'm glad I'm here. I conquered pills with cocaine. Cocaine is an excellent drug. It's particularly good for sex if you enjoy sex from the Neolithic period. And I kicked that galdon cocaine with heroin. Heroin's a very dark, complicated, artistic drug. Then you become a vomiting pig. Just a little hop, skip, and a jump. And alcohol was on the table every day, and I managed to avoid becoming an alcoholic until I was 33 years old and almost dead. I was in a cycle in my early 20s. I was shooting heroin. I got on the West Side Highway in the Bronx to hitchhike down to Manhattan, and my aunt and uncle picked me up on the freeway, on the highway, and put me in the back of the car. My father had just had a massive stroke, and I was taken to the hospital, and I couldn't show up for my old man the night he died. And, man, I certainly didn't plan that. I felt like a pig, like an animal. I had holes in my arms. The curtain was down. The sound of the heart machine couldn't even get through. And I couldn't even go into the room and touch my pop on the cheek and give him a kiss and tell him I love him and watch him carry his light into another room, because my father wasn't moving on. He was dying. He was dead, and that was it. Because I had already rearranged my life to accommodate alcoholism so severely that that's what it was for me. It already had landed in all those areas in my life. The ice around my heart had already become so thick that that's what the deal was. And it was so horrifying to me that I couldn't show up for him the night that he died. I just collapsed as a son, as a man, as a brother. And I had to do some really fast work. I couldn't be that guy. I couldn't. I used to tell my wife, I can't fit the pain in my head. So I came up real quick with that it was needles and it was dope, it was heroin, and I just never had, all I had to do was never put a needle in my arm again and I wouldn't be that guy. I would be some other guy, and I didn't, not for 13 years. I just drank till I didn't want to be a drunk. Shortly after that, I was acting in a Broadway play, and this new usherette walked in with long brown hair, and I took one look at her, and we've been married for 27 years. And we were in our early 20s. I was acting on Broadway, and we had a great time, a great time. You know, one of the most misquoted lines in the Big Book of AA for me has always been, I've heard people say that my worst day in here is better than my best day out there. No. No. I had a great time. Let's see. A pound of cocaine in an all-female jazz band or a panel at the prison. I don't know. Actually, what the cat says at the end of chapter 3 is, I wouldn't trade my worst day in here for my best day out there, because I won't trade this way of life. I won't live like a loser anymore. But my best day out there was really good. Really fun. A really good time. If you're new, you're going to hear some wacky stuff about alcoholism. Some of it in AA and outside AA. Some of it might make sense to you and some of it might not. Some of it doesn't make sense to me. I've never found any of the stuff I find a little annoying in the actual Big Book of AA. I've heard people say that alcoholics don't like change. Just don't like change. I don't like change I don't like. But I love change that I like. I've never heard a guy get to the podium and say, oh, I hit the lottery, I'm having sex with identical twins, it's killing me, I just hate change. I've heard people say that alcoholics are perfectionists. I'm a pig. There's one place I'm a perfectionist. When my wife is caring for me, I seem to have an outbreak of perfectionism. Otherwise, I'm in pretty good shape, you know. But my favorite, and I love this, I've heard that alcoholics are above average intelligence. I have only heard this at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I have never heard it at an Al-Anon meeting, ever. Oh, they're smart as whips. God bless you. Actually, you know, they did a study years ago. It's written about in the 12 and 12 about common traits of alcoholics. And we were waiting for massive intelligence, you know, and all this. And they came back with the primary one was immaturity. At any rate, Nancy and I started our life together. We had our first son, Micah, who was really welcomed into the world by our community. We were surrounded by friends and family and got a ton of phone calls. And
and he was really welcomed into the world. And in just 2 years and 9 months, our son Jesse was born, and in that 2 years and 9 months, we had become completely isolated by alcoholism. No one even came to the hospital the day he was born. There was not a phone call, not a flower, not a balloon, nothing. And it wasn't because people didn't love us. It just hurt too much to be around us. We pressed ourselves on the people around us like a thumb upon a bruise. It was just too hard. And, man, there's no better way to be in hospital than on the maternity ward. You know, it's a great place to be. It wasn't a great place for us to be. And I got a call from this doctor I'd never met before that night. Jesse wound up sick. He wound up in a neonatal intensive care. This doctor called me that night and said, "Mr. Redmond, your wife's under severe psychological duress. There's nobody here. And your son's in an incubator. Where are you?" And I said, "You know, I can't find anybody to watch my two-year-old son." And this doctor said, "I'll tell you what. I'll give you my address and my phone number. My husband's home, and he'll take care of your son so you can come here." This is a major metropolitan hospital. That's a pretty remarkable offer. And I said no. I had no way to accept this woman's generosity. And now my poor son had to be locked in the house with me. This insane man racked by guilt and shame. I would have done better to take him down to the hospital and leave him in the waiting room with a coloring book. At least he could have got the hell away from me. This is how small our life was becoming. You know, I started out on Broadway, and this is where we wound up. This was a good day in the Redmond home. A couple of months before I got sober, I got into an accident, and I went to the hospital, and they said, "You know, your blood pressure is over 160 over 110. You're going to stroke out. We need you to bring your blood pressure down, so you're going to have to lose weight." And I said, "You know what, I would like to lose weight, but I drink alcohol and smoke marijuana before I go to bed every night, so I'm not going to be able to." And the doctor said, "Why don't I prescribe some medication for you?" And I said, "What a country." And he prescribed chloral hydrate for me, which is a knockout drop. It's like getting hit in the head with a sap. It's a fast-acting knockout drop. And I love these pills. I love, love, love my knockout drops. So Nancy comes home. I'm eating handfuls of knockout drops and slamming my arms into the wall to keep myself awake to enjoy my knockout drop. Because you don't want to waste a perfectly good knockout drop. So I'm eating handfuls of these pills, ramming body parts into the wall until I just seize, keel over. Now I'm up in bed. I'm incontinent like the rest of the 33-year-old in America because I can't get out of bed. I got too much Vicky in me. So I'm wetting the bed. And one night I got up and wet the wall. And my wife was excited the next morning. "He wet the wall. He's headed towards the bathroom. This is great. You know, we got some movement here. It's a Wheaties morning in the Redmond house." So to say that our lives were getting small is a grotesque understatement. By the time I got sober on April 22nd, 1985, my careers were gone. My wife was a tongue-chewing, babbling idiot from prolonged exposure to me. My sons were 6 and 3, and they were a wreck. Jesse was playing this, pretending that he was a robot, but he couldn't stop playing that he was a robot. And later on, when he got some help, it was felt that he just felt that it was just safer to be made out of metal. It just hurt too much to be made out of flesh and blood. And Micah was reading years below his grade level. He was cut out from the society of other children. He was grinding his teeth. His small motor skills were all screwed up, and there was nothing organically wrong with him. He was just so distracted from being so scared. And I hadn't read our book. I hadn't read about the warped lives of blameless wives and children. I hadn't read the third or second chapters. I hadn't read about the thinking that becomes hardwired into the friends and families of alcoholics. I didn't know about what's the use anyhow. My children, like so many other children in alcoholic homes, had become pointlessly aggressive en route to a goal they couldn't reach, or they just threw in the towel. And I didn't even know it, and we were dying. We were dying en masse. And on April 22nd, 1985, I crossed the line I swore I would never cross again. I swore I would never put a needle in my arm again. I just drank till I didn't want to be a drunk. And I did that day. Why?
Why not?
It was time. Whenever a guy with a couple weeks says to me that he wants to drink, I always kind of think, or I say to him, well, it's time. Don't you think? You know, and then something can happen maybe. Maybe he and I can talk. Maybe we can take an action, a seemingly disconnected action, and maybe he won't drink, you know. And I called my therapist of record in my 18th year of psychotherapy, my first Jungian therapist. I called him that morning. I told him what I had done. And he said to me, I didn't know this at the time, the exact same thing that Carl Jung told the guy who 12-stepped the guy who 12-stepped Bill Wilson. He said to me, there's absolutely nothing that could be done for you. I can't help you. I said, what are you talking about? He said, the only thing I could suggest is that we have you institutionalized. And now this Carl Jung didn't say to Roland Hazard, or you attend a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous or Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, why I went to the AA meeting and didn't go to the mental institution, I absolutely couldn't tell you. I mean, most days I would have, you know, I like dental surgery. You know, normal people don't like dental surgery. I do. So the mental institution's a chance to be with my people, colorful and adventurous people, and it's an uninterrupted source of narcotics for a period of time. I don't know why I went to the AA meeting, but I did. It's a complete mystery to me. I did. I went to a place called Unit A in the deep San Fernando Valley. I took one step into this room. I looked around, and I said to myself, oh, my God. My God. Alcoholics Anonymous. How did I wind up in Alcoholics Anonymous? How lame is this? This is beyond lame. This is beyond church, beyond synagogue. This is some plateau of lameness I never even imagined was available to me. Alcoholics Anonymous. And the room looked like it was the product of like 200 years of inbreeding. I swear to you. There were like identical twins carving each other's initials on each other's feet in the back of the room. And everything was a miracle. I'm a miracle. You're a miracle. The furniture and coffee are miracles. I'm waiting for the Jew hunt to start. I know that's going to break out, right? Come on, Jaime, strap on these antlers. Always wanted to run a big buck Jew. I hated it. Everything about AA. And then the unsolicited AA information guy came up to me at the end of the meeting. You know him. He's got a belt buckle large enough to serve an entire fish on. I love him, right? Yeah. Do I want what you've got? No. No, but thanks for spitting on me, Clyde. I appreciate it. When do we hook a rug? I know the arts and crafts is going to start any minute. My skin crawled. I couldn't believe it. I went back to that meeting every morning for a year. Because I was out of plans. I was flat ass out of plans. If you're new here and you've got a plan, it's probably a butte. Don't use your plan. Grab one of us after the meeting and tell us your plan. We want to know the plan. I'll tell you my favorite newcomer plan. And it's the most utilized newcomer plan I've seen since I've been in AA. To this day. It's the one more dope deal to set myself up financially for sobriety plan. I stuck around Alcoholics Anonymous for 3 months and worked, accepted the and enjoyed the gift of step none. I did nothing, and I stuck around 3 more months and did the same thing, and I'm so lucky I stayed sober for those 6 months. I knew I was going to drink at the end of the 6 months. My wife had reached out to the Al-Anon family groups and had started pursuing her miracle. And I'm so grateful she did. She was a great example. She said she saw it in me, and I saw it in her. I knew I was going to drink. I had seen the drill hundreds of times in just 6 months, so I asked the guy to sponsor me. And he made sure I'd done some reading from the big book of AA, and he invited me over to his house, and he read chapter 5 to me. And on the way through, he took me through the first two steps, and we reached step three, and we got on our knees and said a prayer, which I felt was embarrassing and unnecessary, but I did it anyway. And then he went back and he gave me instructions on how to do a fourth step from the big book of AA. And I stopped feeling like I was stealing somebody's seat here. And I went back and read my inventory at 9 months. I did steps six and seven for the first time, which have really become the gut, the fulcrum, the centerpiece of my working relationship with God and my tool for change. And it came time to do my eight-step list. And I try to share this any time I talk. It's the best reading of step eight I've ever heard. And I heard it, I was a couple of weeks sober at my first home group, and there was a hospital group there. And there was a guy there named Nino. He had never seen the book before. He was there with a hospital group. He had hospital plastic on his wrist. I'd never seen him before. I've never seen him since. He had a heavy New York accent, and he was reading chapter 5 for the first time in front of this group of men. And he got up to step 8, and he read, "Made a list of all those we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all." Jesus Christ. And he looked out into the room as if to say, "Have you seen this? Do you know what the hell is in here?" Man, it was the purest reading of the step I have ever heard. Ever, ever. Because it's the only thing I saw on the list. Everything else went into soft focus except for that, you know. I'm going, no, not those people, not that money. If you're new, don't worry. It's eight steps from where you are anyway, for God's sake. And eight's not the annoying one. Nine. It's the one where you pay them back. It's So I wrote my eight-step list, and my wife and kids were down there, and I didn't know what I was going to do about it. And my dad was down there, and I didn't know what I was going to do about that. And I had a sponsor. I don't know if he did this for all the guys he sponsored, but he did it for me, and it was the perfect thing for me. He refused to tell me what to do. He refused to play God with me and give me his idea of what I needed to do to make amends. Man, am I lucky. He could have saved me a lot of time if I had done that, because it's taken me many years to make those amends. And it's been a pleasure. You know, when I was 12 years sober, I looked at my eight-step list, I looked at both of my sons' names, and I crossed them off. It wasn't because of an event. It was done. We were current. We were in the pocket together, you know. And, you know, the same thing happened with my dad after I got to hold a sponsee while he took his light into another room. At any rate, he said, "Do your job at Alcoholics Anonymous," because I couldn't sit down with my sons or my wife and apologize. It was just ludicrous to even think about it. He said, "Do your job at Alcoholics Anonymous. Address your inventory as your spiritual task and do your job." So I started doing my job. My disease reacts very poorly to a frontal assault, to a direct assault. Anytime a guy I sponsor says that he's working on himself, I want to go, "Step away from yourself. Step away from yourself, sir." And I was encouraged over and over again to take these seemingly unconnected, unrelated actions. We bleed it out. We starve the beast out. We go to the prisons. You know, that's what we do. And that's what I started doing. I started hanging out with people who did more when things got good and more when things got bad. They were always doing more. You know. And I hung out with a bunch of great guys, and I had to show up at my kids' school and tell the teachers my kids were sick because they had been living with me and I had been ill and we're going to make a beginning. And the boys got tested and diagnosed and we got help and we got resources and they're these incredible, robust, gorgeous grown men today. You know, you told Nancy and I not to get involved in our first year and we didn't. We stayed the hell away from each other. I mean, I had nothing to bring to my marriage at all. I was broken, you know. I didn't know how to fight. I'd either scream at her until she shut up, or I'd cry until she shut up, one of the two. I like the tyranny of helplessness. It's always worked for me.
And I'm a loomer. I like to loom. I'm big. I like to loom with a light behind me. Get her in a shadow. It's like Total Eclipse of the Jew if I get her, like, right in there, all right? And if I can, like, get a scream, a cry, and a loom into one fight, that's a hat trick, man. That's communication. I got nothing. I got nothing. I can't even clean my own house. I don't feel like a grown man. I don't know why. I don't know that grown men make the bed. Make the bed, you know. I think somewhere in the back of my twisted mind that a certain amount of housework should equal a certain amount of sex. That there should be like conversion tables on the back of cleaning products of housework to sex. I'm bringing nothing. I started doing stuff around the house. I'm annoying the crap out of my wife. And she said, what are you doing? I said, I'm just trying to be of service. She said, it's a marriage, not a coffee commitment. Yikes. And our family made a beginning, and just remarkable stuff started happening. They said that the boy's small motor stuff, which was deeply affected when they had special ed, they said, why don't you get him into music, get him into sports. Let's see if the big motor stuff will impact the small motor stuff. And we did. Jesse wanted to play drums, so I went, and I didn't have any dough. I bought him a drum pad. It's a piece of wood with a piece of rubber and two sticks. But my kid wanted something, and I got him something for the thing that he wanted. And that was really different in my house. Instead of just talking a whole lot of crap and it never happening. And I went back to my home group, and if you got a home group like my home group, you'll know exactly why what I'm saying. And I told the guys what I had done because they wanted to know, because they were interested in my family, because they were rooting for us. You know. And within like 3-4 weeks, the AA drum set showed up at our house. There were like a lot of burnout drummers in our group at that time. And guys are showing up with these Megadeth drums and, dude, and, Jesse would sit behind his drum set and, like, disappear. You couldn't even see him. This little tiny voice would come up. And a couple of years ago, my sons played the House of Blues in L.A. on Sunset Strip and burnt the dump down. Burnt it down. Killed it. Played this house like 800, 900 kids, playing hip-hop music, elbow to elbow, and just killed it, you know? And off to the side of this group of weeping middle-aged alcoholics, you know, down the day. The kids are kind of going, what is with the crying old people? What is that all about? That's a whole new deal, right? And it's their AA and Al-Anon aunts and uncles that have been following them around all these years. And I don't think that's because God likes us more than the people whose kids have been annihilated. I can't live in that world. I won't live in that world. We got nailed in the Northridge earthquake. Some of you might remember that one. It was the last big one in L.A., and our house got smashed up, and I got a physical injury. A guy died right near us. It was really bad. And shortly after the quake, we went to this AA function out of town, actually up in Canada, and this woman who used to live in Los Angeles came up to me at this function, and she said to me, oh, I'm so glad God got us out of L.A. before the quake. And I said, oh, so he likes you. He likes you. But wear crap, but he likes you. And she said to me, I guess he just felt you had some lessons to learn. I'm out of here. I'm out of here. I can't live in that world. I can't live in that world with a God saying, get him, get the Redmond boy, get him. Get him, no evacuation plan for you, Jew boy, get him. Get him, turn his wife to salt, kill his goat, put a finger in his eye, kill him. Smote his ass, smote him, smote anyone he talks to, smote them all. I can't live in that world where I got a God saying, let's key your car, it's boils for you, you're due for a rash, don't you think? My God expects me to do my job in Alcoholics Anonymous if it's to show a guy how to stay sober through two robust young men who are in the glory of their lives.
or if it's how to stay sober through the annihilation of children, and I've seen people stay sober through both. I'm having a great time in my marriage 27 years in. I don't believe that's because God has not assigned us a divorce. I can't live in that world. I won't. My God expects me to do my job in AA. If my job is to show a guy how to be in the kind of in a wonderful relationship with lots of problems, you know, or how to go through a sober divorce. My God's not doling it out. He's helping me hang in the pocket. I believe in the big book of AA. I believe in the big book of AA. It says the same thing that the mystics say, that St. Thomas says, that God is absolute and complete mystery. To know God is to not know God. And every time I ascribe an intention or a personality to him, I cut the ring on myself like a good boxer. I make my life a little smaller, you know. And I don't want to live that way. I want the broad highway. I want to be part of the great reality, the big idea. Our book says, join us on the firing line of life. Help us to pack things in the mainstream of life. I want a big, sexy, robust sobriety. If anybody here, if you're new, and anybody says, that's the way AA is, I steer clear of those people. When I was new and people said, shut up, you're a moron, sit down, I stayed away from those people. And I've stayed away from them for 18 years and 10 months. And in my area, there was this idea that some of these old-timers were like, well, they're very wise, they've been around for a long time. And about 3 or 4 years in, when I started working the steps, I went, no, they're mean. They're mean. Because there's other old-timers who are going to meetings, working with newcomers, still doing self-examination, and not doing that other stuff. You know? And I thank God I judge no man because I'm too spiritually developed. What? What? I've had a lot of problems in sobriety. I know that there are some people who don't have problems in sobriety. I'm serious. I'm happy for them. I have. I've had problems with money. I've gone up. I've weighed more than 300 pounds in sobriety. I've had terrible smoking problems. I've had terrible problems with money. What does this have to do with sobriety? Absolutely nothing unless you're going through it. Absolutely nothing unless you're filled with shame and self-loathing and it's affecting your effort to do service and get out there. And I want to tell you that I want to encourage you, if you've been around here for any appreciable amount of time, and there's a part of your life that when it comes around on the lazy Susan, you just go, oh. You know, a friend of mine in AA says this, and I love when he says it. You know, he says, it's like when a guy borrows some money from a guy in a meeting, you know. Let me borrow some money from you, Rich. I'm short, my tax return's coming, I'll give you the money back. So a guy lends me the money, tax return, if it comes in, something else has to happen. So there's Rich. So now I got to kill Rich. Right? Rich, kind of a jerk. The guys who hang out with him are kind of jerks. That meeting he goes to, that's a jerk meeting. I'm not going to that meeting. I got to kill him. Every time it comes around, I got to kill him. How many of those did I have when I came into AA? Hundreds. My life was like an extremely painful, tiny wound. It was like a paper cut. And what's happened as a result of using the inventory process as a lever for change and a way to participate in service, I've wound up with this gigantic, robust, gorgeous life. Alcoholics Anonymous was founded by a bunch of niacin-eating, acid-dropping, Ouija-board-playing wackos. Read the history. These guys were seekers. All of our framers and founders were seekers, voracious seekers. They did sit up and play with a Ouija board. I want Ouija board sobriety. I want that kind of seeking. My sponsor was the kind of guy who used to call me and say, I got this new thing, this new prayer, this new approach, this new spiritual teacher who I'm listening to enlarge my experience of step 11. You know. And you're still on the Neolithic period, aren't you? And
if I don't stay current with the inventory, I will leave Alcoholics Anonymous. Me personally, I will leave because I get pissed off at people in AA. I don't know, really. Because I don't just hate things the way normal people hate them. I hate things in a way where I wake up and I water the hatred like a little flower and I care for it and I make sure that it's okay. The worst thing is to when I forget to hate something. And a guy goes, hi, and I go, hi, oh, I hate him, why did I do that? Then I've got to redouble my snubbing and glaring just to reestablish my hatred for the guy. I hate so that when my head hits the pillow, it becomes a rotisserie. You know, these resentments eat my brain and my heart and turn my life black and throw me out of my own life. So if you're new, I want to urge you. I want to urge you to take what's here. And it's what's here. And because I've stayed current, I've had a lot of problems in sobriety. And I must tell you that I'm really having a good time. I really feel like I'm in the game. If you're new, the good news is that our problem mainly rests in our mind. AA, the big book, is the only text about recovery from a fatal illness that I know of that contains the sentence, we absolutely insist on enjoying life. There's no book about cholera that says, cholera is a hoot. You'll love cholera. You'll meet other people with cholera. Then you'll meet people who just caught cholera. Ooh. My sponsor used to say that AA was the only recovery from a fatal illness he knew of that left the sufferer in better condition than they were in before they contracted the disease. And the bad news is that our problem mainly rests in our mind. My alcoholism used to go below the horizon, stop presenting itself as a real piece of business, and I would drink again. And that's what would happen. No matter how I tried to keep it buoyed above the horizon, no matter how much I tried to focus on it, no matter how much therapy, no matter how many tricks I tried, I couldn't keep it above the horizon as a real and present danger and a real piece of business. And what's happened to me as a result of working the steps, inviting this mystery, this incredible, radiant mystery, this connective tissue of loving and being loved in AA, my alcoholism has actually been buoyed above the horizon as a real piece of business for 18 years and 10 months, even when I don't focus on it, even when I'm not trying. Because I've taken these seemingly disconnected actions, and it's buoyed on the shoulders of the men and women of AA and on this power that you've introduced me to. The bad news is our problem mainly rests in our mind. Some years ago, I met a new guy at a meeting, and he called me when I got home from the meeting, and he talked to me for an hour, and I said, uh-huh, four times, so he'd know I wasn't dead. And he shared with me that he had been stalking several women, he had a restraining order taken out against him, but he's 2 weeks sober, and it's different now. And at the end of the hour, he said to me, man, I really feel all alone. And I said, what are you talking about? I hardly even know you, and I just listened to you for an hour without interrupting. What do you mean you feel alone? And he said, well, I don't have a woman. And I said to him, what exactly would you be bringing to a relationship right now besides stalking skills? What are you bringing to the deal? People 2 weeks into remission from leukemia are not having dating problems. Alcoholics are, because our problem mainly rests in our mind, because it goes below the horizon and it becomes a trivial deal. Some years ago, my wife was walking through our bedroom and she knew I was talking to a new guy, and she heard me saying to the phone, let's say the aliens are coming. So she stopped short. She ain't missing a word of this. I said, listen, man, I'm not telling you the aliens aren't coming. They might very well be coming. That's an outside interest. I'm not telling you the aliens aren't coming. I have one question. Why you? Why have they come for you? Why have they traversed a universe for your sorry ass? Why? You're 11 days sober. You have no life. Don't you think they'll go to a post office or call a cop? Why you? Plus, he's sleeping with a Bible on his chest to ward them off. So they're going to traverse the galaxy, walk into his bedroom, and go, oh, no, the Bible, let's go home. So I go to my home group a couple weeks later. I'm telling the story, and the cat in the story walks into the room, and I'm looking at the guy, you know, and he's listening to me tell the story. He goes like this, man. If you're new, I want to urge you as much as I possibly can to take this thing as you seriously can. Take this thing as seriously as you can and go out there and have the time of your life. If the aliens are coming for you, welcome to AA. Welcome home. Thanks for having me to your party.